Bonjour.
Bonjour. Call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order on today, February 19th. In the Fran Camp Room, present we have Senator Hoffman, Vice Chairman Mackey, and myself, Chairman Senator Lehman. And we have three bills I'd like to get through today, at least take testimony on, all dealing with insurance. Senate Bill 202, Motor Vehicle Insurance, Senator Donnelly's sponsor. Senator Donnelly, would you like to testify, or you want James to?
I'll testify.
Okay. And just to remind anybody who wishes to testify on any of these bills, please sign the list if you haven't. Just in case he forgot how to crack his law.
Got his lawyer with him right there.
No, attorney-client privilege.
Yeah.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the opportunity to be before the committee today. Sponsor substitute Senate Bill 202 really has its goal to correct some of the unfairness and the current settlement practices that are going on in the insurance industry in the state of Alaska. I think it's the complement to the tort reform legislation we did last year. As you know, for many years, as we struggled through tort reform, there was a lot of concern by parties over insurance reform, and that while we were trying to prevent abuses to the system by claimants, we were also trying to prevent abuses to the system by the insurance industry to make sure that they fairly comply with their contracts with their insureds and fairly dealt with their claims practice. And the changes that are designed in 202 by most part are fixes to that problem. First of all, Section 3 of the bill says that an insurer could not terminate a contract with an insurance agent except for good cause. This seems like a self-evident thing, but fortunately, I was talked to agents over the summer who felt intimidated in that if they were to be independent and stick up for their constituents, the people they had sold the insurance to, they felt threatened by some insurers. Also, they wanted the security that they wouldn't be fired for refusing to do illegal acts or requests from insurance companies, that they could not fear that the insurance companies would have to have a legitimate reason for firing them rather than they were refusing to perform an illegal act, wanted some level of protection. I noted in the response to this particular section from the National Association of Independent Insurers letter, which the committee may have, they pointed out that this provision would provide greater benefits to those type of agents than other employers in the state were required to give. But, you know, insurance is not like any other business in the United States of America, Mr. Chairman. It's the only business that's exempt from antitrust law. So it should be regulated differently than other businesses since they have this special exemption that applies only to them and any other business in America has to fall under. So they do have unique provisions, and this seems incredibly fair. It's just a very important safeguard to consumers that their own agents should feel free to legitimately stick up for their own interests of their clients without having the fear that some insurance company will fire them in retribution for refusing to break the law. Section number four is a problem that I think is showing throughout the industry right now, especially in the automobile claims practice, in that people who repair automobiles no longer see themselves as working for the person who owns the automobile. They see themselves as working for the insurance company that's going to pay for the repairs of the automobile. And what this does is make it clear that insurance companies could not limit communications between first of all agents and insureds and also people who would repair property that's damaged. There's no good public policy reason for a company to tell an agent what it should or should not communicate to the insureds if it's a legitimate information those people need to know. And there's certainly no good reason why repair people should feel intimidated and say, we can't give you an estimate for that because your insurance doesn't cover it. They should move ahead and give people appropriate estimates for whatever the owner of an automobile or any injured type of property wants without having to serve the insurance company. The insurance company is required to pay that if it's an inappropriate loss estimate or if it's something that isn't covered by the insurance. But the way it works now is all the repair people are so intimidated by these insurance companies, they won't even give you an estimate on your actual damages unless the insurance company thinks it's okay. And that's just wrong. They should be working for the people who have the damaged property and not the insurance companies. So what this says is it would be improper for the insurance companies to limit that communication. Of course, the response that was provided says, well, we know of no practice in which insurers prevent communications. Well, I can give you an example from my own personal experience trying an automobile repair this summer. So it is a practice and it is going on. Whether it's very informal and secretive, and the companies will never admit it, it's a fact that they will do this, or at least they will intimidate people into doing it. And it begs the whole question to know that we know of no practice about this, so why would you do this? And then the argument that's made here is, oh my goodness, somebody might file a lawsuit against us if they thought this practice was going on. Well, that's pretty nonsensical, frankly, Mr. Chairman, to have a response like that in writing. I was amazed by it, because the chances that somebody's going to spend all the time and money to file a lawsuit over an alleged communication failure, especially given we have a Rule 82, that if they fail to prove it, and we have to pay the insurance company their insurance and their attorney expenses, is just ridiculous. So this is a straw man argument that just begs the question and really doesn't respond to a problem that's out there for consumers. Section 5 of the bill was requested by the Department of Motor Vehicles. I worked with them on that, and it appears, I think, that's a separate piece of legislation also that the committee has on the agenda today, and that's Senate Bill 158. If the committee's preference was to deal with it in that bill, I'd have no problem deleting it from my bill. I was simply doing it as a service to the department, who suggested it was an appropriate thing that the Senate should look at in dealing with this area of the law. It really applies to some of the problems that have occurred due to the use it, lose it law, as I understand it, and that if people are administratively revoked for alcohol-related offenses that didn't relate directly to driving, it could seem unfair that they would subsequently, other people in the household would lose their insurance capability. I've had several people contact me about this problem coming up. I don't really understand it as fully as people from DMV could explain it to you. I hope somebody's here from them today, or possibly the Judiciary Committee folks that have introduced the bill that the Judiciary Committee's done by request. So I would defer on that, except to say I do think there's a problem in this area, but I'd be happy to have it deleted from my bill if the committee's choice was to deal with it as a separate vehicle.
Senator Donnelly, just, and sorry to interrupt, but just for your information, we have heard the other bill by this committee, and we have it back up today, and I expect we'll be dealing with it. I'll offer that to the representative from the sponsors to, if they want to combine it with this one, but I would guess I know the answer to that. But I won't presume to know the answer, but I'll offer that to them.
I didn't know it. The department told me
right.
They'd like to see this. I didn't know we already had a bill.
No problem.
Section 6 deals with prejudgment interest. Frankly, this is a kind of a complex question that may take me a minute to explain to the committee. When you have an insurance policy and it has a limit, a policy limit involved with it, and the damage has reached that limit, under Alaska law and case law, there's a requirement that prejudgment interest be paid. And the question at that time becomes, should the prejudgment interest be paid by the insurance company or by the insurer? And for several areas of the law, this has been decided by case law. When it comes to the minimum statutory automobile policy, the Supreme Court has held that the insurer is obligated to pay prejudgment interest even beyond the statutory minimum. In several other circumstances, the courts have held that's applicable. There remains a slight gray area. In those automobile policies that are beyond statutory minimums, if you went and bought yourself a higher limited policy, and for some reason the damages hit that maximum, who would be responsible for the prejudgment interest beyond that? And from what I can figure out of the industry standards right now, some of the larger companies are paying those prejudgment interests, while some of the smaller companies, for example, Progressive, are refusing to pay prejudgment interest, which is causing litigation on the subject. And frankly, I noticed that there wasn't a comment to that in the only written response I've gotten to the bill so far. And that might be because I think sometimes in these cases, the industry sees it as advantageous to set a single rule for everybody, because then everybody's playing in the same playing field, and it's easier to establish your rates. When there's different insurance companies involved, you don't have excess exposure. So I'm not sure what the testimony is going to be for today from the industry about this, but I'm looking forward to hearing what it will be. I do think this is clearly the appropriate policy call for several reasons. First of all, the average consumer, when they buy this policy, thinks they're buying is protection from judgment. And unless the policy covers prejudgment interest, what you have is the case where, because insurance companies write into the contracts that they control the defense of the insured, the insurance company can negotiate a policy limit settlement. And if they then subsequently refuse to pay the prejudgment interest on that amount, the poor person who bought the insurance policy is left hanging with that obligation. And they didn't get to participate in their own defense because that is contracted away to the insurance company. So in those kind of cases, the insurance company could go ahead and settle, which would be in its own interest, and the insurer gets stuck with the exposure for the prejudgment interest. And I think that's probably the reason why some of the bigger companies, and I believe this is what we'll hear from them today, why they go ahead and have agreed to pay this in many circumstances, because it's the only fair thing for their insurers. And those companies that are refusing to pay it, frankly, you know, if consumers understood this problem, you know, in an ideal world, we'd have very sophisticated insurance consumers, but we don't. And people don't figure that they're going to have a problem like this until it actually happens. And then it's too late to switch insurance companies and make sure you've got this kind of appropriate coverage. So that's the issue that's presented here. And I think we may find, I'm hoping that the industry will recognize that this would be advantageous to them to have a level playing field on this issue. Section 7. Really gets to what I think is the most important part of the legislation, and that's a change in the way claims practice is conducted in Alaska. Currently, we have a situation where if the insured and the loss, person who suffered the loss, and the insurance company cannot reach an agreement on what an appropriate compensation is, these negotiations can go on for months until somebody files a lawsuit, and they go to court, and they fight this out. And all this time, the injured party probably receives no compensation at all. And the insurance company wants them to agree to their dollar amount before they will pay them anything. And I think that's just not right. I think the way the system ought to work is that the parties get together, they have a discussion, and if they disagree, then they ought to, at least, the insurance company ought to be able to ascertain what at least the insurance company thinks is an appropriate level of compensation, and to proceed to pay that, and then have the dispute focused on the difference between what the insurance company thinks is legitimately owed and what the claimant thinks they're entitled to. So the fight now becomes over a much smaller dollar amount, and there's no longer the economic blackmail hanging over the burned out family or the person in the hospital who needs some help with medical bills or the person who no longer has an automobile and can't get to and from work. There's economic blackmail hanging over their head unless they agree to what the insurance company's terms are. They're not going to get anything to make themselves, put themselves in this, to recover from this injury that's occurred to them. So we're not in this. I'm not proposing the insurance company agree to everything that a claimant wants, just that they go ahead and pay what even they acknowledge the claimant is appropriately owed. And then to go ahead and go through whatever you want to go to, you know, if you want to file a lawsuit or just continue to argue or dispute it, whatever procedure you want to use to argue about the difference after that time. It just seems to make a lot of sense. It would prevent a lot of the horror stories we're hearing from people about not being able to resolve issues of medical damages or fires and things like that, where people are really legitimately, seriously, obviously injured through no fault of their own. And yet, because they can't, they won't agree with what the insurance company offers them, they get no compensation.
Sir Donnelly, can you crank things up? And
sure.
We've got people signed up and several other bills, and I'm just, so you can pick up the pace.
Okay. The next section deals with arbitration, and I actually wrote this section into law back many years ago in an effort to improve the current system of arbitration we were using. Because at that time, the arbitration clause in the state statutes said that the parties would equally share the expenses of arbitration. And because of that, and because insurers hold all the economic advantage in that kind of a situation, they could always undervalue a claim by the cost of arbitration and eliminate the whole point of going to arbitration. So we tried to adjust to that by saying that we'll leave it to the arbitrator to award to the prevailing party the cost of the arbitration. Thus allow people to get to an arbitration procedure simpler and more easily, more fairly. But the insurance companies have gone through some gymnastics to avoid the arbitration once again by requiring that people pay the arbitrator up front for the cost of the arbitration. So once again, we're back to where we were before we changed the law, saying that, you know, once again, if your upfront costs for paying the arbitrator are greater than what your costs of potential gains by going to arbitration, it's becoming pointless to get there, and there's also people can't afford those costs. So this proposes that this ought to be a responsibility the insurance company bears to pay for the cost of arbitration, and if in fact the claimant was unreasonable, the arbitrator can award the cost to the insurance company with the insurance company can collect against them at that time. So that's the safeguard there. Section 9 is just intends to set out some premium limits for what insurance companies can charge for 7-day premiums. And the response from the National Association of Independent Insurers mentions that somehow this would require a new type of policy. It doesn't do that. The policy is required in existing law. I think it does point out the fact that the insurance industry has been violating the existing law for, at least some companies have been violating the existing law for quite a few years now by not operating the mandatory offer here of 7-day policies. They've chosen to ignore that. There's been several bulletins from Division of Insurance to insurers around the state ordering them to comply with the statute as it now exists. But the very fact that this respondent letter fails to even acknowledge that exist, that law even exists, shows you that how problematic this is to the insurance industry. Some people don't even realize that is the current law, and they're not offering these things. And here, I'm trying to set out a reasonable policy amount for those kind of offers, so that the companies, once they do start to follow the law, don't avoid the effect of the law and the intent of the law, but simply charging an outrageously high premium, so nobody would ever afford to get it in the first place. And we're trying to make sure that we give a fair amount here by saying it's a 200% of the prorated. That's double what it would be if it was just prorated, to make sure that they've got the cost, because these shorter periods for these are obviously going to have more administrative overhead costs for them. We're trying to compensate for that in a reasonable way. The medical section deals with medical claims. It's the same as the property claim section, that you go ahead and pay what's actually owed. And, there's one other section I just further rush through this, and that's the telephone contact, that the companies be required to either have an in-state number or a statewide toll-free number for being able to contact them. We've got a lot of companies that sell business in Alaska that don't have any local phone numbers. Sometimes the insurers don't even know who they are. It's really hard to get a hold of them, identify who they are, and it seems really appropriate, and the division is supportive of this language. Division insurance just required that they're going to be doing business in Alaska. There ought to be a listing somewhere where you can call them to talk to them about your plan. So I'll try to rush through it there, Mr. Chairman. That's what it does.
Questions of Senator Donnelly? I do have one that I'd like you to respond to, and it has to do with the Section 3 part of the bill. You talked about the reason for it is just to protect legitimate exercise of business, and yet I have letters, which maybe you don't have yet, that were just handed to me from three agents of State Farm saying they oppose this, because, and they say, or looks like probably, well, they say that they don't want the state interfering in their contractual relationship with the company. I guess my reading of that is not that that's what's happening. What's your take on it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think there's a lot of different opinions among independent insurance agents and agents that work for specific companies. I think there's tremendous pressure from the companies on agents to toe the line. And I think also there's probably room for legitimate disagreement. Some agents are probably very happy with their relationships with their companies. I don't see why any company would be that concerned with a due cause provision. I mean, due cause can be all kinds of reasons. And what it isn't is for some illegal reason. And so I don't see why this would be particularly bad for anybody. And I don't think it's government interference with the issue of private contract, other than the fact that we do have a very unique industry here that is exempt from antitrust laws, and nobody else is, and has traditionally been regulated differently than other private industries for good reason. I would think that if we didn't have the antitrust exemptions here, and if there was truly a free market, it might not be appropriate to regulate them in this way, because there would be a true free market in the insurance industry. But given that, and given the other elements of insurance, how it's regulated differently, I think this is a good safeguard for consumers. But I do acknowledge that a lot of companies have excellent relationships with their agents, And I think it's perfectly reasonable for individual agents to think that everything's fine, where it's probably real reasonable for other agents to think there's a serious problem, and also for those agents to be rather reluctant to come forward and talk about it.
Sir Mackey?
Yeah, Senator Donnelly, I want to follow up on that too, and, you know, I totally understand all of the circumstances that you mentioned, your own experience and other experiences that have been brought to you, so I'm somewhat naive about that situation. I guess I too am a little bit reluctant to, just about in all things, I like to try to draw the line where we have government interfering in private enterprise, and although it may be unique, this industry in your eyes, they are a private industry, and I guess I don't know why we would want to tell them what they can or cannot contract with people for. I guess I'm trying to understand, you know, a little further why you feel that's important. I mean, is there circumstances where if independent agents agree to pay the claim and say, okay, your accident, you know, you're justified in having this payment, that they're afraid they're going to get fired by the company because they paid a legitimate insurance claim?
The chair.
Sir Donnelly.
Well, they certainly shouldn't be afraid to say that. And that's what this language is intended to make sure that they're not afraid to express their own opinions to their clients, to go to bat for their clients, to give their clients advice that may not be in the best interest of their particular company because they're representing their clients in the matter, and legitimately so. One thing that's kind of amazing about some of the language in these letters the committee received, I just received it, says, one of them, Ed Randolph, I am strongly opposed to government interference with the issue of private contracts. Well, Mr. Chairman, insurance agents in Alaska, we already directly interfere with their private contracts. And in that, they're the only people in Alaska that are forbidden by statute to discount their services. I, as an attorney, can charge somebody less if I want to. You, as an engineer, can charge somebody less. But we have a statute that says an insurance agent is not allowed to discount their fees. And yet, here they're arguing they don't want government interference. Seems like they kind of want it both ways. They want the government to make sure that they don't have a free market, but they don't want to be told that they even have to have any good legitimate reason to terminate somebody. And I think that's kind of amazing that you'd see that kind of testimony in writing, given the fact that they enjoy this incredibly unique and sometimes very questionable special state protection.
Do you have any idea why that's in law? Did that precede you?
It preceded me by quite a bit. Over the years, as we've had a discussion of this, the case has been made that if you allowed insurance agents to discount their fees, that you would not, the public wouldn't receive the same level of service that it currently does because you'd have a competition to drive costs down, and the way to drive costs down would provide less service. You could discount your commission, so you charge less, and then the public would suffer in the long run because agents wouldn't really be providing the level of service they are under the current scheme where they're not allowed to discount their fees. I'd be happy to trade their statutory protection for fees they discounted for this provision any day. I'd like to see a free market myself. But given that we don't have a free market, that they're not allowed to discount their services, you know, I think this is clearly appropriate to put some protections to the public that they're being fairly communicated with, and the agents that they're given this guaranteed rate of return don't have other restraints upon their communication with their client.
Further questions? Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Sarah McNair Grove, where you are. Same seat. Yeah, they might as well just have that with your name on it.
My name is Sarah McNair Grove, and I'm an insurance analyst with the Division of Insurance. As we've looked at this bill, as the agency that would be seeing whether companies comply with it or not, we had several questions that were raised, exactly what the intent was and how we would enforce them. So what I would like to do is just briefly go through the various sections and raise the concerns that we have and solve it might cause problems if that would be.
That would be fine. And do you have that in writing, or could you?
I do have it in writing.
Get it to us. Great. We'll that way we can work on it and cause answers to come to the committee.
The first one is in Section 3. It's been the historical position of the Division of Insurance that we do not interfere with a contract between the agent and the insurer. That is their business arrangement. And we view this as the testimony that you have from these agents as an interference in their contract. And yes, it's not our historical position and what we do at the moment. We do require that agents and producers have a contract, but we do not require that we see it. We do not have any provisions as this is what your contract must contain. When an insurer cancels a contract with an agent, they do have to give the agent a reason for that termination. And if it's for cause, we as the Division of Insurance do investigate to be sure that that termination is in compliance with statutes and is not done illegally.
Sir Mackey.
So you're saying that there already is for cause a provision now that if they terminate a contract with an agent that you have to investigate that?
The chair, yes, that's correct.
So I thought you said.
That's not what I heard you say. I heard you say if it's terminated, then you investigate to make sure that it's for cause.
If it's terminated for cause, we ask them what the reason was, yeah. And we do investigate, yes. This proposal says terminated for good cause, and it leaves it up to the Division of Insurance to write regulations as to what that is. Again, our role is to see that insurers comply with the statute, and for us to determine what good cause is really a legal matter rather than a compliance issue, and so we have a little bit of problem being the ones to determine what is good cause and what is not good cause.
So on that point, if I could interrupt, when you ask for information, when the contract has been terminated for cause, what do you do with it? You're just interested in it?
If it's something which is against the current statutes, then we do investigate. And if it's an illegal action, we take the appropriate action. If it's a valid reason for terminating it, then.
If it's, well, it may not necessarily have to be valid, just be not illegal.
Right.
As long as it's not illegal, then.
Then there's nothing we can do about it.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Please proceed.
Section 4 is the section that prohibits a person from limiting communication. It seemed to us that the scope of this was a little bit broad, and I don't think it was the intent. But it does include other person representing an insurer and insured, which could lead us to say that maybe the attorney is included in this. I don't know that that's the intent, but it could be construed that way. So we have might want to just look at the language there to be sure that.
Do you have suggested language that would tighten it?
Not at the moment, no.
But could you get that to us? Great, thanks.
Section 5, as we testified on SB 158.
Right, you can skip that.
Section 6 on prejudgment interest. This is placed in Chapter 42, which in the insurance title, it deals with policy provisions and is required only of admitted insurers. We might suggest that maybe a more appropriate place is to put this in Chapter 36, which deals with trade practices, because then it would apply to non-admitted insurers as well, and it would For personal autos, it's probably not too big of a problem, but there is no limitation here to those, and so it might be more of a problem for commercial policies.
Okay.
It's also, we have assumed that the intent is to say that prejudgment interest it should be paid in addition to the policy limits. Again, from the language as written, it's not exactly clear that that would be the way it's intended, and if we have assumed, made the wrong assumption, then, you know, it needs to be clarified exactly what it is. Also, we're not quite sure how this prejudgment interest would be calculated. Is it to be calculated on the total amount of the judgment, or would it be only calculated on the policy limits? And that could be a very different amount if the judgment is much higher than the policy limits. So again, just in terms of our enforcing it, we would like some clarification as to what's happening.
That's a good question.
Section 7. We already do have regulations in place which provide time frames for insurers to respond and pay claims. And so some of this is redundant to the regulations which are already in place. Again, by placing this in Chapter 42, it applies only to admitted insurers. And again, 42 is the chapter that deals with policy contract provisions rather than the behavior of an insurer, which is Chapter 36. Also, in our reading of it, seems like there's maybe a conflict between sections B and C. B says that if you can't reasonably determine what a loss is, when that point in time comes that you can determine what the value is, you have 15 days to pay it. C says within 30 days after you receive notice of a claim, you have to pay it. And so this 30 days could be before you know what the value of the loss is, and it's kind of hard to require someone to pay something that they don't know what the value specifically is. So maybe there's some things there that could be worked out a little bit better. And also in Section D, again, just we're not quite sure how this is going to be applied when there really are legitimate coverage disputes with the penalty that would be required.
Senator Hoffman?
Under this section, you know, I have an individual in my district that has had a fire, and in December of 1986, and he's been fighting with the insurance company since then, and he still hasn't moved into his home. What can he do to expedite the process if, you know, many of the things in here are redundant to current law?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the law requires undisputed, or the regulation requires undisputed amounts to be paid. I believe it's within 30 days, so if there's a disputed amount, that would not apply, but if he thinks that there's something wrong, the certain contact recognition would help in any way that we can to get things moving.
Well, he's hired a private adjuster as well, and even with that private adjuster, claim hasn't been finalized.
The
15 months later.
The regulation also does specify that once a claim has gone into another forum, a court of law or something like that, you deal with the time frames in that. In that forum, so there may be something there that's happening. Section 8 with the our trader's fees, we have no objection to that, although it is a little bit unclear to us what would happen if the arbitrator asked the insured to pay some of those fees and the insured was unable to do so. Was there a collective process that they need to be involved with? And it's just not clear whether that's the intent or not. That might be the intent. Section 9 is the 7-day policy. By putting a specific number like this into statute, one of the problems can be that this sort of tends to be the number that everybody wants to use. And so there may be some other ways around this that we could suggest or maybe look at rather than putting in a specific number, but in order to keep the premiums at an unreasonable level.
You're talking about the 200% limit?
Yes.
What about the, and I didn't ask this before, Senator Donnelly was up there, but it's being changed from no more than 7 days to essentially 7 to 30 days. So it's really changing this short-term policy. And I assume this then means that we would no longer have the 0 to 7 day policy, or somebody could offer it, but they wouldn't have to offer it.
Right, you could offer a 7 day or a 10 day or a 15 day or a 30 day
policy. Right, but what if somebody had need for a 3 day policy? There's no requirement.
There's no requirement.
Right. Is that your intent?
Yeah, the 7 days hasn't worked because insurance companies just aren't offering it. And what I hoped was to give them an option to go from 7 to 30 days. If somebody needed for 3, buy it for 7, it doesn't seem that significant much more because you can't buy it now. And even though the statute says it should be available, in most cases it isn't. And then to try to set in some reasonable compensation for having that option.
I'm going to belabor this, but there are times, for example, when I want to move a truck and I don't even want it for 7 days, I might want it for 7 hours. I just need a trip policy just to, boom, there's, and then it's done. And I have been able to get coverage sometimes.
And the last section then that I would like to mention is section 12, the medical cannabis coverage. We would suggest that this be structured more along the lines of the underinsured motorist coverage. As it's written now, it's in Title 28, which is the Division of Motor Vehicles, and insurers are regulated under Title 21, so you might put the mandate in Title 28 that it be offered, and then the how to offer it in Title 21 is currently done with uninsured motorist coverage.
Okay. Questions? Thank you. And if you can get that pretty much into us.
Can I ask a question?
In response in writing, sometime we'd appreciate that. Sir Mackey.
Can I just ask, so if these sections are clarified that you pointed out, most of it's clarifications I think that you're asking for.
Right, these were things that is if we are to enforce this, we saw some problems in enforcing it, and so these were issues that came up.
If those things are clarified, is the division supportive of this legislation?
At the moment, we have no position on it.
Except for Section 3, they didn't. Well, I guess your testimony was that's not your current policy.
I'm sorry,
Section 3, yeah.
So you're opposed to that section?
If bill is a total, we don't have a position on it.
All right, this is not directed at you, but perhaps when you come back, it helps someone like me to clearly understand where the division or where the department is coming from on some of these issues rather than not having a position. I think I have that frustration with some of my own bills that departments don't take a position on. They insinuate some things, but they don't take a position. It's hard to understand where you're coming from. And if you're charged with the responsibility of administering the program, it's helpful to find out if you think it's doable or not. And again, it's not, you're very helpful.
I understand, and I will see if you can get an answer for you.
Do the best you can to be as frank as you can in position. And it'd be great if section by section you're going to say support, don't support, no position. If when it gets into these technical areas, then, because I think it's possible, since some of these are almost standalone provisions, the rest of the bill doesn't depend on some other sections, we may be able to pull some out or even change them.
If I can just follow up, the reason is I don't deal with this stuff. You folks are the ones that manage these programs, and it helps me to know whether it's doable or not based on your experience dealing with people and their problems as well as the insurance companies.
I understand.
Okay, thank you. So too harsh.
Okay. Thanks, Sarah. John George. Standing by, Michael Lesmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John George. I'm here today representing the National Association of Independent Insurers. And Senator Donnelly has already given some of my testimony as he was reading from the NAII position paper letter. And I won't go through each paragraph that they're position letter does a pretty good job of that. But I would like to talk specifically to a couple of things. One, Senator Donnelly referred to the antitrust provisions, and it is absolutely true that the insurance industry is exempted from antitrust for the limited purpose of collection of data. They can all send their data to a rating bureau who collects it because insurance is based on large numbers. If you only wrote 3 cars, you wouldn't have any idea what your experience would be. But if you can write, put all of the data from all of the cars in there, you can actually get an appropriate rate for insuring a car. So the limited exclusion from the antitrust provisions is to rate making. Every time there's a meeting with more than 2 insurance companies, the first thing they do is have a disclaimer and say, you know, remember, we are not exempt from antitrust. Don't talk about, you know, what we're going to pay agent commissions among companies. Let's not talk about, you know, competitive things, because they are subject to antitrust for that, and they know darn well that they will get nailed for it. So they have very limited antitrust exemption. As far as interfering with contract, and insurance is different, and it's one of the few industries where someone tells them what the policy has to say. They have to file the rates with a regulator, and the rates have to be approved. They have to fall within a range of adequate, not excessive, and not unfairly discriminatory. Extremely regulated business, and then people complain because the policy doesn't cover what they thought it should cover, and it costs too much, when really all of those things are subject to approval by the regulator. As far as an agent contract, though, with an insurance company, that's really a different kind of a product. And it would be the same as the state interfering with any other employee-employer relationship or agent contract provisions, and we just don't feel that that's appropriate. If, in fact, a written contract exists, it was negotiated, both parties agreed to it, and I dare say that most contracts would not say, and you must not challenge us for doing illegal things, or you must do illegal things under this contract. And obviously, that would be against public policy, and you probably could go to court on that. We just don't see that the Division of Insurance as an insurance regulatory agency should be involved in agent contracts. Senator Donnelly talked about rebating, essentially changing your commission levels. And that actually maybe one point that Senator Donnelly and I agree on. I've always thought from my previous life as the director of insurance that was certainly something that should be reviewed. The actual history of that goes way back in life insurance, when life insurance companies on the first year premium would pay an agent 105% of the first year premium as commission. So you go through the phone book and you call everybody in there and say, I will pay your first year premium for you. I pay $100 premium for you. The company gives me $105. That's not a bad deal. I make $5 for every policy I sell, even though I've given back the guy 100% of his premium. And it caused the companies to have extreme costs to issue policies. And of course, the second year, when the commission was 5% of the entire premium, the agent wasn't going to pay that. The guy said, I don't want the policy anymore. And I mean, see it just like a snowball. Not really a problem in property and casualty insurance. And in fact, there are lots of creative ways that agents and brokers do get around different commissions. Some companies will quote a policy to an agent at 3 different commission levels. You tell the guy if you want to sell it A, B, or C, one's 5%, one's 10%, one's 15%. They may call them different, you know, things. They may have a little difference to have a difference. Certainly brokers have been doing things on a fee basis where they say, we'll do this net of commission. So there is no commission paid by the insurance company. I want $50,000 for the level of service I'm going to provide, and that's negotiable between the insured and the client. So there are ways to get around that. We just don't think that this is an appropriate way to deal with agent contracts, and would resist that. We do have a problem with the requirement that claims be paid within 30 days. There's lots ready to pay in 30 days. Nobody knows what it really is. Your medical situation hasn't stabilized, or we don't know what the parts coming from Germany are for your Porsche, or, you know, there's just all kinds of things. There's also the case that some claims, believe it or not, actually may involve fraud. It may not, but it may look like it involves fraud. Well, we may need more time to investigate. And we feel we have an obligation to our other policyholders not to be too quick to pay claims that we really believe are questionable. May turn out we find out, yeah, it really is a good claim, pay it. And there's certainly unfair claim trade practices, unfair claim settlement practices after that, that, you know, come to bear on that. But there are times when, you know, you just say, wait a minute, let's pull back. And Senator Hoffman, I think, you know, maybe what we're seeing in the plan that you talked about, there may be something there, and I don't know anything about it, but, you know, there's a dispute there. The claim normally would have just been paid if everybody agreed that this is the amount that ought to be paid. And, you know, I don't know if there's an insinuation that it might have been, you know, arson, or that the claim is being inflated, or that it really wasn't coverage under that section for, you know, the loss of use, or, I mean, it's all kinds of possible things. And I think if it's gone that long, one of two things: either there really is a problem that is being investigated, or they really should go to the Division of Insurance and file a complaint and get somebody to look at it, because it shouldn't take that long. Legitimately, if it's a straightforward claim, there's no excuse for that. And without deciding on any side, the division at this point ought to get involved and determine, you know, what's right and what's wrong. And if the insurance company is wrong, they will be slapped severely above the head and shoulders with a sharp stick. Toll-free telephone numbers. There's some question in my mind whether that applies only to insurance companies. The word insurer in the insurance code can apply to an agent, a broker, possibly even an adjuster in some cases. I'm not aware of any other industry that's required to have an 800 number. A local hotel has one because it's their competitive advantage to have one. But there's anybody that regulates hotels that says you will have an 800 number. Your bank probably has one because it's a competitive advantage. Insurance companies generally will have them because it is an advantage to have them. But it may be that they only write one policy in the state of Alaska, and I don't know if it's still true, but it used to be that you could get an 800 number that worked everywhere else but Alaska. Maybe they, you know, didn't have one in Alaska because they only had one policy. And if that's important to you as a policyholder, then you buy your insurance from someone that does. I would think that we need to make sure that we're not talking about an agent, though, because an agent in Anchorage that happens to write their brother-in-law's policy in Juneau would have to have an 800 number so that you could call from Juneau to Anchorage toll-free, even though they certainly have an Anchorage number. And if it's important that you want a local number, then buy it from a local agent. There's other people that testify, and as I say, my clients do a good job of outlining most of their concerns. I'd be more than happy to answer questions and get back to you on anything that's been discussed, or if you want me to bring up other things on different sections, be happy to do that. But I'll just leave it at that and be brief and let the other witnesses testify.
Okay. Thank you. We don't have any questions right now, John. Michael Lesmer, standing by our old friend, Joe Flood, my former representative.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Michael Lesmeyer. I'm here on behalf of State Farm Insurance Company. And one of the biggest challenges we face in our business is the challenge of affordability. And it's a fact of life that in Alaska, you need insurance to drive an automobile. You need insurance to buy a home. And anybody that's in business needs a form of liability insurance. The problem is our products aren't much good unless people can afford them. We're looking at legislation that in the years that I have here before the legislature has the potential to more dramatically increase insurance costs than any other piece that I've ever seen. And I would urge that you look at each one of these provisions and ask the question of whether the problem is so widespread that it justifies legislative action, number one, and number two, what is the cost and the benefit of the solution that's being proposed? Because these solutions do impose costs and will impose costs. And that is something that we think is a paramount issue for us and is a paramount issue for everybody in the state. We just finished returning to Alaska policyholders $6.6 million, State Farm Mutual did. Over the last year, and our claims history is improving. Legislation like this is going to change that trend, and I'd like to tell you why. We look at this legislation, we say number one, it's unnecessary. Number two, it's expensive, and you got to be aware of that up front. And number three, it's intrusive. And I think I'd like to talk about the third issue first, which is the intrusiveness of this legislation. State Farm Insurance is sold by independent agents. State Farm has a relationship with 32 independent agents in Alaska. And for more than 50 years, the relationship between State Farm and its independent agents has been set by contract, and those contracts provide for a termination without cause. In other words, the relationship is built on trust, and it's sustained by trust, and it's been a good relationship. And if you look at our 32 agents in Alaska, you'll see that it's been a good relationship. 14 of those agents have been State Farm agents for more than 20 years. 21 of them have been State Farm agents for more than 15 years. And 27 out of the 32 have been State Farm agents for more than 10 years. There have been only three terminations in the last 9 years. There seems to be this idea that there is some form of problem with the relationship between agents and insurers in Alaska, and if there is, I'm not aware of it. Even with our contracts in which the agents are terminable at will, there is a covenant of good faith and fair dealing. It's implied in Alaska law in all contracts, and I don't think that any insurer could terminate an agent for not doing something that is against the law. The difficulty is, though, when you take a relationship that is based on trust, and you say that somebody else is going to be the arbiter of that trust, you destroy the basis for the relationship. And we are strongly opposed to this provision in this bill. We wonder why it's there, what is the need for it in Alaska, who is this supposed to protect, and what is it supposed to protect them from? Because it hasn't happened in Alaska. There has been no specific examples of this in Alaska. I don't believe it's happened. And frankly, this issue of agents being influenced by their companies to do illegal activities in other states, I'd like to know what the senator is referring to. And I'd like to know specifics because, again, what is the need for this kind of legislation in Alaska? I suggest to you that the covenant of good faith and fair dealing already gives a certain level of protection to agents and would prevent the exact kinds of things that the senator is concerned about. I would also suggest to you that our agents are adamantly opposed to this legislation. The second of the three issues that I'd like to raise with you is that this legislation creates a new private cause of action in Alaska that presently doesn't exist. And it's a cause of action that will occur on a regular basis. What this legislation does is it says that requires a claim that is, quote, reasonably determinable, unquote, to be paid within 7 days. And I can tell you that in almost every case where that is going to be an issue, there will be a secondary lawsuit for the kinds of increased penalties and damages that this legislation creates. And again, I ask, what is the need for that legislation? We look at the Division of Insurance. The Division of Insurance already has the power to investigate those kinds of practices. They already have the power to take action against insurers if they are engaged in those kinds of practices. And I also suggest to you that in cases where there is delay, for example, many of the cases involve issues that are very seriously in dispute and issues that are not easily determinable. And you will always have litigation over that. And with this bill, you will have more litigation. The other thing that this bill does is it creates a form of bad faith cause of action. And those in states that have had those forms of bad faith causes of action, third-party bad faith, the cost of insurance has gone up dramatically. And I predict to you that even though this involves a director of the Division of Insurance and that and says that the director has to first determine that an insurer has violated it, this is an expensive process both for the Division of Insurance and ultimately it will be for the people of Alaska. Again, I would encourage you to ask the Division of Insurance as to whether there has been problems in this area. Because certainly there will be individual insurers that are always unhappy with the status of their particular claim. But what I would urge you to do, if there are such stories that are brought to you, you look at both sides of the stories, because I would say to you that there inevitably is a legitimate explanation for what is going on. The third thing this bill does is it creates mandatory offers of medical payment coverage. And again, the question is, what is the need for those mandated offers of medical payments coverage? It seems like a technical issue, but these coverages are widely available today, if I'm not mistaken, and I haven't heard the justification for yet another mailing at the time everyone renews their insurance policy. And a mailing of what? That's not described in this bill. What are we supposed to offer? What are the limits that we're supposed to offer? Again, those are the kinds of things that lead to litigation and the kinds of things that, unless there is a justified need for, you ought not to mandate it by statute. That's all I have right now. Thank you.
Senator Mackey.
Yeah, you made a statement that concerns me, and that is, that this legislation will be expensive, it'll cost the consumer more money. Can you expand on that just a little bit and just tell me how it's going to raise individual policyholders' rates?
Well, the concern that we have is that it creates a new cause of action. And it creates a new cause of action that will be a largely common cause of action. In other words, there will be great pressure on insurers to not dispute claims that they should be disputing. And if they do dispute them, the follow-up is the cause of action that is created in Section 7. And what happens is if the insurer disputes the claim and loses, there's a cause of action for reasonable actual attorney's fees, actual costs, interest, and a penalty equal to at least 20%. That's not present in the law right now. And if you go on down further, then there's the potential for bad faith claims practices against the insurer. We don't presently have bad faith on the part of a third-party claimant in Alaska. We do on the part of a first-party claimant. And this kind of new cause of action has been demonstrated to be expensive in other states. And there are some statistics, for example, from California and I believe from Arkansas, where they didn't adopt this exact same thing, but what they did is they adopted third-party bad faith, and the cost of that was dramatic. And the concern about this is one of, number one, I guess, an insurer may just go ahead and pay claims that they reasonably should dispute, and if they're wrong, they suffer a huge penalty. And the door explains one way. For example, Senator, we spent a number of years dealing with the issues of tort reform, and we passed, this legislature passed last year, an offer of judgment provision that says that works both ways. It said if you come into court, or if you have to come to court, and you enter what is called an offer of judgment within the very strict time frames of the legislation, and you lose, you have to pay a certain percentage of the other side's attorney's fees. If you enter it early, you may have to pay as much as 75%, and that provides an incentive for both parties to fairly evaluate their claims and do it early. This just provides an incentive against one party, for one party. It doesn't swing both ways. And the problem is when you create a new cause of action like this, it leads to, ultimately will lead to litigation, and that's where the cost is going to occur.
Thanks for your testimony, Michael. Joe Flood, standing by Jim Douglas, and that's the last person I have signed up to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I was invited here as a consumer who has suffered a loss just recently, and I've been listening to some of this testimony, and Mr. Lesmeyer, for instance, talked about the cost factor. There is already an increased cost factor, and that's what the consumer ends up paying. Let me just give you an example. Last April 25th, we suffered a major loss right here in Genoa in my business. We had a fire. It's been almost a year ago. To this date, it hasn't been settled, and it won't be settled until, well, we've already filed a lawsuit. It won't be settled because the insurance companies, and I've had calls from people all over the state who have had similar experiences, who are afraid to come to people like you because they're afraid the insurance company is not going to pay them. It suffers major losses, and they've been beat up on by adjusters. It's not the agent who sells you the policy. It's the adjusters who come to town with both guns blazing where you have problems. And they demand things that are just terribly unreasonable. I don't know if you've ever sat down and read your insurance policy cover to cover, but it's pretty amazing what the insurance companies can do to the consumer, to the insurer. We have supplied our insurance company with over 3,500 documents, and they still want more. We've duplicated that effort because they've gone to our bank, our accountant, our attorneys, people we do business with, and they duplicate the effort. Then they turn around and take the paperwork and give it to an accounting firm in Seattle, and then charge that claim against me to pay for that bill after I paid thousands of dollars to my accountants and business people to gather that information. I was told in the beginning when we had this loss not to deal with it on my own, to hire an independent adjuster, to get help right away. And I thought, no, that's not the case. You don't have to do that. I know my insurance agent here in Chino, and he's a reasonable fellow, nice guy, not a problem. I was sadly mistaken. We had really phone calls from all over, people saying, don't do it, you'll be sorry. And they were absolutely right. The first adjuster we dealt with, I told them, look, I've got to get that business back up. That's 40% of my revenue. If I don't get it back up, I'm going to go bankrupt. He told me if I hired the contractor I wanted, I was going to slow down the process. If I hired an independent adjuster, I would really slow down the process and we wouldn't get anywhere and I'd really be in trouble. I ended up doing just that, hiring a contractor,
going to the bank and borrowing the money, but it wasn't for the local banks, we would have gone belly up. It was the bank who came to our rescue and loaned us the money to get back on our feet. And the insurance company just recently wrote a letter to the bank and said, have you foreclosed on them yet? I think that's what they want. They want you up against the ropes. They want you down so they can beat you down further, and you'll ultimately end up settling for what they want to offer. I think it's unfair, gentlemen. It's unfair to the consumer, the people of this state, and something should be done about it, especially Section 7 of this bill is what you should be looking at. The consumer doesn't stand a chance. He can't afford to go up against the big insurance companies, their attorneys, and the minions that they hire all over the country to just beat you down, beat you down, beat you down. They can't survive. We need some help. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
I'll be right with you. We heard testimony from the Division of Insurance said that there were some of these time limits that are already in place by regulation. However, it is possible that some of these time limits, what is the term, they toll, then you can continue on when it gets into litigation or some other things. So it's possible that they don't apply, but Ms. Mayor Grove testified to that, and I don't know what the requirements are, but
well, let me just
obviously they didn't apply in your case, or if they did.
Oh, absolutely. We had a certain amount of time to come up with our proof of loss. We had a timeline. The insurance company doesn't have a timeline. We have a timeline. We have business interruption insurance, and I consider myself to be a bright person, reasonably successful in business. But I'm telling you, I'm a babe in the woods when it comes to insurance. I thought because I had business interruption insurance that once we were down and suffered a loss, they'd be there to help us out, but they're not. They don't pay you while you're down. They encourage you to get open again as soon as you can. And then they pay you for that downtime, but they negotiate that down. I was told that because I was doing advertising for my business, I have two stores, one in the Valley and one downtown, that the customers from my downtown store would probably go to the Valley store. Therefore, we can negotiate this business interruption insurance down even further. Well, that's not what I paid for. That's not what I bought.
Sir Mackey?
Yeah, I had two questions. First of all, there was a response to a comment that Senator Hockman made earlier about a situation with a constituent in his district. And there was a response that, well, you know, this doesn't happen. Obviously, there must have been something that was being disputed and so forth. There's two things I'd like you to comment on. I'm not interested in the personal details of your case, but did the insurance company you're dealing with ever indicate to you that specifically what they were disputing in terms of the coverage that you assumed you had?
No.
And second of all, the second part of my question is, did you go to the Division of Insurance and ask them for help, and what was the result of that?
The second part of your question first, Mr. Chair. Yes, I did go to the Division of Insurance and talk to some people over there. And by the way, you wanted to talk off the record as well. It's pretty interesting. They're willing to help, but if you've hired an attorney and you've started litigation, then they can't get involved. And that's where we are. We hired an independent adjusting firm first. We actually thought we didn't need it. We thought we could do it by just dealing with the insurance company directly. And that's when we found out that we were mostly unprepared for that.
Once you have an attorney, the Division of Insurance can't talk to you?
Once you file a suit, no, they can't. Or they can talk to you, but they can't offer any real assistance. They just want you to keep them abreast of what you're doing. Or at least that's how I understand it. We ended up filing the suit, and that's what we're hoping to litigate soon, but that just pushes it further and further back as well. And our fire, to answer the first part of your question, was first called a spontaneous combustion. And State Farm sent a claim adjuster, a specialist from Anchorage down. He he brought up a fireman from Seattle who investigated the fire. This was 3 or 4 days after the fire, I'm not sure. But then they both suggested that it was arson. Went to the local fire marshal. And he changed his mind, now it's an arson fire. Well, there have been a couple of other arson fires in Juneau. And in talking with those people, they've had a similar experience where, you know, you're fighting to keep your head above water, and the insurance company is saying, well, we can't deal with that because the police haven't finished their investigation. We're waiting for them to do that. Well, we're waiting for this piece of information from you, or this piece of information from your attorney, or your banker, or your accountant. They keep pushing it off and off and off and off. And there comes a point when I think what they're attempting to do is just to get you to settle for something less than what you purchased. And I think that that's grossly unfair. And something has to be done about it. They've got a free ride in all aspects, and it shouldn't be that way.
Sir,
well, the individual case that my constituent has is that, you know, he had full coverage replacement cost, and the insurance company that he was with changed their policy January 1 of 1997 that insured residents for 125% of the value of the original cost of the home. So he was still covered for full coverage replacement cost of his home. And he went ahead and hired an independent appraiser, and they went ahead and figured out what the cost was. The cost obviously had inflated considerably since he built his home in 1985. The cost of the home building in rural Alaska is very expensive, and the value of his home had doubled. And he feels that the reason that the insurance company is not willing to settle, from his opinion, is that he hired an independent appraiser, and the insurance company wants to make sure that people in the community know that he hired an independent appraiser, and he's had problems, and he's been out of his home for some 14 months, so that type of claim or that type of practice isn't encouraged.
Senator, through the chair, there is the independent adjusting firm that we hired, Lucarelli and Associates out of Seattle, has done work all over Alaska. And they're currently involved with a group of attorneys out of the Seattle area, I think, and California. We're filing a class action suit because of that same remark. I mean, that's a remark that has been made over and over and over again. Now, maybe it's not illegal for them to make remarks like that, but it sure as hell is immoral to tell you, if you're going to hire independent adjusters and contractors to work for you, then we're going to slow the process down. You're going to have a tough go of it. Now, I don't care what these attorneys will sit here and tell you, or people who are lobbying for the industry, but that they are blind to the true facts. And until you suffer a major loss and experience that firsthand, it's devastating. It really is. Especially when you think that you're close to retirement, now all of a sudden you're debt-ridden. And the people that you paid those premiums to for years and years and years, you thought that they were there to help you, and all of a sudden you find that they're adversaries. That's real difficult to handle, Ben.
Well, this particular family hasn't spent 2 Christmases in their home, and they're still fighting with the insurance company.
I understand that. My sympathies.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for sharing your testimony. Jim Douglas?
Jim Douglas, Mr. Chairman. I'm just Joe's attorney, so we're leaving together.
Oh,
I wrote down no there in the comments.
You sure did. I apologize for not noticing that. Thanks for being with us and for sharing that.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wish to testify on Senate Bill 202?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Donnelly?
I believe the Division of Insurance should correct something they said.
When we're talking about the regulations that were in place, it's the undisputed amount, which is one of the provisions in here that has a time limit on which they pay. And once it goes to another form, then we use the time. But I just want to be sure that you understood that distinction.
Right, I did hear that.
What she means is if it's disputed, if the insurance company doesn't agree to settle for what the injured party wants, well, then they're not going to force them to pay. because that's a disputed amount.
For any amount?
Right.
Or would it be just the disputed amount?
It's the whole amount.
Let's say that they want $10,000, and or they want 10, and the insurance company is willing to pay 5. Do you require them to pay the 5?
I'm on that end, no, but the regulation does say the disputed amount. I'm sorry, the undisputed amount must be paid. And so I don't know the answer, but I can find out how we can.
Okay, you've asked some other things you're going to get to us as well.
And just thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one thing, Mr. Lesmar asked for some examples of where it's been a problem. I believe all the members have in their packet the article from the Public Tribune that identifies the scandal that took place in Utah regarding former State Farm agents coming forward and testifying under oath about illegal acts by the company.
Okay. Thank you. With no further testimony, we'll close the public hearing on this. We're going to hold Senate Bill 202 over. I'd like to get some of those answers, and then we'll bring it back for the committee and then deal with some of those sections. I would say that most likely we'll pull two sections out and deal with it in another piece of legislation.
Thanks.
Senator Mackey.
Senator Donnelly, I noticed you were making notes on some of the comments that were made. You'll bring back comments on those particular issues.
I'd like to work with the division on some of the issues.
Yeah, it sounded to me like there were some areas where you and the division ought to talk, and you weren't too far apart on some things. Maybe. Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, Senate Bill 158. It's dealing. You can deal with it real quick. If you don't want to.
Oh, yeah. 3 o'clock.
This was a bill that we heard before, and
I like this bill.
And I think the only reason we held it over to see if there's any other concerns, and then I believe we were asked to tighten up the title. And so we have a committee substitute that has a tighter title and hasn't yet been adopted. I'd like to do that. Senator Mackey?
I'd move CS for Senate Bill 158. It's the 42698 839-K version.
Okay, is there any objection? So we have motion carries, and we have adopted the committee substitute with the tighter title. Joe Ambrose, did you wish to testify? Is there anybody here? John George, you were just signed up to answer questions. Is there anybody who wish to testify on this bill? Is there any committee discussion regarding it? Senator Mackey?
Is it your intent to move the bill?
Yes.
I would move SB 158 to our information.
I'll just object this for a second so I can get back to Joe. I was going to ask you the question. Your preference, keep this bill and not, since the provisions are the same as the other bill, I just want to hear it from you. I presume that it was me, but I might as well hear it from you.
This bill differs slightly from the language of 202. I think it's tighter. It only addresses one issue. I believe that the sponsor would prefer to move this
piece of legislation. Yes. Okay. I will move my objection. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the motion carries, and the Senate Bill 158 is reported from committee. Is there anybody here to testify on the 283? Can you stay for 283? Can we get, or should, we're out of time.
Hold it over.
We're at ease. Yeah, two people signed up to testify. Well, actually, one, Sarah, you just said no, but you're just available for questions, I guess. And John, if we hold this over until next Tuesday, is that any problem for you? Is there anybody else here who that's a problem for? If we hold this bill over until Tuesday? Okay, well, that's what we will do. And let me just note that Tuesday, we are scheduled to take up House Bill 73, the ASME 1% assessment. Senate Bill 268, the Department of Labor Wage Claim Assignments, and then the state locate standards, and if it's introduced in time, and then this bill that we've held over. Anything else coming for us?
Thank you.
Yeah.